Welcome to Coming Clean, the podcast dedicated to common sense environmental dialogue, environmental optimism, and real environmental solutions. This show is proudly powered by Orsted. Welcome back to Coming Clean with your host, Benji Backer. I am in person and really grateful to be with an iced tea friend of mine and a new friend of mine, Rich, and he's at BlackRock. He's had a leadership role at BlackRock for many years. I'll actually let you introduce yourself because I think your title as head of portfolio management group and senior managing director for BlackRock doesn't do it justice. So I'll let you go over that. And then I want to get into ESG, everything about your strategy, and go from there. But welcome to the show, and thanks for making the time.
Well, it's great to be here, Benji, and it's great to spend a little time. Yeah, so I run the portfolio management group at BlackRock. I've been at the firm for 32 years this month, actually. What that means is I oversee the investors at BlackRock. So as I tell people, it's been a long time since they let me buy a stock or a bond, but I manage the investors and the investment processes. And so I've had a lot to do with how we develop our thinking around the markets, as well as around things like sustainability in the energy industry.
Well, and you guys have such an incredible scale of impact. Can you just talk a little bit about that? Because you oversee a lot of that, and it makes the world a better place in a lot of ways, but it also has the scale that I think a lot of listeners might not realize.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it's important to understand who we are and what we do. And a lot of people don't understand what it is to be an investment manager. Right? We're not a bank. We're not an insurance company. So BlackRock manages about $9 trillion, give or take. None of that money is our own. Right? It belongs to individuals or pension funds or other institutions. In fact, well over half of the money that we manage is being managed for someone's retirement. A teacher, a lawyer, a firefighter who's saving for their retirement. That's our responsibility. Our responsibility is to produce the best returns we can for them. You know, I joined this firm shortly after it was founded. We started with 8 people and $0 under management.
Wow.
Today we have about 20,000 people around the world. And as I said, $9 trillion. And we've been able to grow it because we've delivered for our clients. We've created the investment returns that have allowed them to have a dignified retirement or achieve their financial goals and at a fair price. And that's what we keep on doing.
Well, one of the ways that you've tried to, you know, serve your clients is also thinking about what impact those investment dollars have on the world. And so you've really made a big priority to invest in ESG, which, you know, is environmental and social governance. It's something that has been a big priority. Can you, as someone who has been here since pretty much the beginning, can you talk through what that process looked like and what kind of the general strategy is for BlackRock as it's approaching this today, but also kind of how it started and how you've seen it evolve?
Yeah, sure. Look, a couple things. One, ESG has become a little bit of a bad word. I don't know how that happened, but it's really about taking into account a variety of different factors as they affect the investment world. What you've seen, as I think you've seen a kind of evolution of what sustainability is and what sustainable investing is. But I think the most important thing that we focus on is choice. Mm-hmm. It's not our money. So the investor chooses. They choose their objective. They choose their time frame. They choose their constraints. Sometimes we have investors who don't want to have us invest in alcohol or in tobacco or firearms or sometimes in energy. Mm-hmm. That's their choice. Within the choice that they make, everything we do is about performance. Our job is to drive investment performance. And so given the objectives and the constraints that our clients choose, my team's job is to produce the best investment results they can. And as I tell people, I've got about 2,000 people who work for me, who manage the portfolios at BlackRock. Not one of us gets paid based upon the temperature of the earth. Mm. We get paid based upon the investment results we generate. And the last part is that we do it on research. It's not based upon a political view. It's not based upon the way the world, Larry Fink or Rich Cashel or anyone else wants the world to be. It's based upon research that we think is going to going to affect asset valuations and asset prices. And so, yeah, we have clients who choose to invest with a specific sustainable goal. And we are, you know, happy as heck to manage those portfolios for them. The vast, vast majority of people just want us to produce investment results. But that doesn't mean you put your head in the sand and don't take into account important governance factors, material factors around the environment, or even around social issues that are going to affect asset prices. They're going to affect the valuation of a company. And so, you know, it's strange to me that investing has become so politicized. Mm-hmm. As I said, I've been doing this at BlackRock for 32 years, and I've been in the industry for 35. Never really kind of anticipated that. But that's a bit of the world we live in.
Well, and I think that you're actually alluding to something that we've struggled with too, which is that environmental issues themselves have become so polarized and politicized. You deal with backlash from both sides all the time. And, you know, the people on the far left, if you can call it that, are saying that you shouldn't invest in fossil fuels. People on the far right say that you have some agenda to change over energy. On the flip side, who are very pro-fossil fuels, forget about the politicization of it for a second. Can you just talk about what you're seeing from the economic and investment case of investing in sustainable solutions, the trend that you're seeing, the reason why this is so important, regardless of the political noise?
Sure. Look, there is an energy transitioning happening. Whether you think that's good news or bad news, that's up to you. It's happening. And so that we know that the world requires a lot more capital for energy than it has. Bloomberg put out a piece, I think last year, that said that anticipated we were going to need $4 to $7 trillion of annual investment a year for energy. And that compares to about 2.4. So a significant uptick in the level of investment in energy, renewable, traditional, everything. And so that tells you that energy as a whole is going to take a growing slice of the investment pie, and you better be prepared to take advantage of that. So, you know, when I think about it, we do believe that an orderly transition is going to be good for the economy, and it's going to create a significant investment opportunity. Said differently, a disorderly transition will do the opposite. And so I don't think an energy transition can happen without an all-of-the-above approach that prioritizes energy security. It prioritizes reliable access to affordable energy. And it also prioritizes lower carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. And some people, again, don't like that. Some people do. That we're going to need these things. And I think traditional energy companies are going to play a huge role in that transition. Mm-hmm. We know that big swaths of the world need to decarbonize, really moving from coal to natural gas. We know and we saw that, you know, post the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the importance of energy security, and the reality is that, you know, the reliability, particularly here in the U.S., provided by traditional oil and gas, is going to be critical. Yeah. So I think, you know, my team's job is to invest for returns, mm-hmm. Not to try to orchestrate some view of the world. While lots of people kind of think that that's what we do, we're trying to, you know, have some normative view of the way we want the world to be. No, that's not what we do. We try to make money for our clients, and I think energy investing is going to be a really important part of that.
Well, let's dive into that a little bit further because, I mean, as I mentioned, you've received backlash from both sides, but obviously very front-facing. You've been in the news as a company with states like Texas and Florida who have really spoken out against BlackRock investing in their states with this sort of mindset. What do you say to the people, including maybe the governors and the politicians of those states who criticize BlackRock's relationship with energy? You've alluded to a little bit, but what do you say to them who are critical, but they also think that that you have this evil agenda? What misconceptions do they have that you have to fight back against? What do you say to them? What does that conversation look like?
You know, Benji, it's kind of funny. We've been accused of, and we've put on lists for, quote, boycotting oil and gas. And again, this may be good news, this may be bad news. We are the world's largest investor in oil and gas. We have over $310 billion invested in traditional energy. And by the way, that's up over the last 3 years from about 260-something billion. And so it's a significant uptick from where we were. And that's because we see it as an investment opportunity. So the notion on its face that we're boycotting oil and gas is kind of absurd. And by the way, we also are a significant player in the infrastructure around it and in the smaller providers, in E&P companies, in midstream, all different parts of the ecosystem. That said, we're not a bank. We're not financing, right, you know, individual little businesses. But we are investing with the sole goal of producing the best returns that we can for our clients. So the notion that we're an energy boycotter is a little tough for me to swallow. You know, all that said, look, I think it's important to understand that some of this anti-ESG legislation, as it's called, and we see this in a lot of forms, you know, we have to have a better dialogue around this. There has to be a better, richer dialogue than some, oh, you're on a list or you're not on a list. And I think people are starting to understand, and we've seen this, that the problems and potential costs that come out of these bills, and those costs and those problems are being borne by, you know, the pension plans, the retirees in the state. And so we're spending a lot of time in all of these states having conversations with the policymakers, having conversations with our clients, and working hard to hopefully make certain that, you know, they understand the implications of these policies. But I think there is a growing body of evidence that's emerged and research that shows that these boycott lists and these other efforts to restrict investment access, what they do is they curtail competition in ways that will, you know, increase costs and lower returns. And it's open competition that produces the best product at the lowest price. And, you know, I'm very proud of the job that we have done for our clients in Texas, for our clients in Oklahoma, for our clients really all around the world. And we were talking the other day, you know, these are real things. And you've seen a number of different, you know, pension fund leaders around the world, including in some of the reddest red states you can imagine, come out and say, you know, if you do this, it's going to cost hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars. Or said differently, it's going to cost 10, 20, 30, 40 basis points of return. You know, 25 basis points of return doesn't sound like a lot, a quarter of a percent. When it's applied to a huge pension fund, it's the difference between that retired teacher getting a COLA increase this year or not. Mm. Right? Think about that. Mm. You know, I ran into my fourth grade teacher a couple weeks ago. I would not be the one who has to tell her, who's a great lady, but, you know, very much retired, you know, that she's not getting a COLA increase this work because this year, because some politician decided to, you know, target an asset manager or a bank or some other company.
So where does this attack stem from? Like, I guess, obviously, there's two parts of that question. Where does it stem from in terms of why is it happening? But what's their justification for it, for those who don't know? Like, what are they telling you, or what are they telling the public, for those who haven't been following it very closely? Why would they oppose this so adamantly? And what do you do to combat that?
Well, look, I mean, we combat it with facts. But let's talk about some legitimate concerns,
right,
that I think are out there. And I think you have to recognize this. You know, one of the models around sustainable investing, which has been very popular mostly in Europe, it's about what you don't do. That's what I call it. It's about what you don't do. You don't invest in fossil fuels. You don't invest in defense companies. You don't invest in alcohol. It's all about what you don't do. And frankly, I do think that that ultimately restricts the investment universe and restricts the opportunity to create returns for clients. Mm-hmm. And so I think that sustainable investing kind of gets tarnished with that approach. And by the way, some of our clients feel very passionately that kind of approach aligns with their values. And you know what? If it's your money, you can choose your values, but those aren't BlackRock's values.
Right.
And so I do think that sustainable investing has to transition. It has to transition to being about what you do, right? You do invest in innovative new technologies. You do invest in life-saving biosciences. You do invest in things that are going to promote a better economic growth for people. And that's important. And so I think part of the backlash has been targeted at this, ooh, what don't you do? But they forget and they target that at BlackRock or even at other managers who are acting on behalf of their clients. Mm. You know, one of my very first clients at BlackRock was a very large religious denomination in the United States, happened to be headquartered in Texas, great folks. And they were very clear that they did not want their portfolio to have exposure to alcohol or tobacco. And I think this is back in 1992. And I recall that was the first time I had ever dealt with that. That's aligning with their values. That's not an investment decision. You know, our job is to create the best possible returns given the client's chosen objectives. And so, you know, I think for us, it's about making certain people understand that. I do think that there is a legitimate concern that we're hearing from clients and companies that we invest in the energy industries, that the availability of bank financing and sometimes even insurance for small companies, small businesses, not the Exxons, Conocos, Phillips, Valeros, all these great companies, but just, you know, the mom and pop small businesses are having a tougher time finding financing. They blame that, and I don't know whether it's true or it's not, on the concerns at the banks about their own sustainability profiles. I think that's a legitimate concern. I just think that the kind of way that it's been being addressed is misplaced.
And on that topic of energy and the diversity that you have to deal with in from a day-to-day basis, that you really are focused on the return aspect, but you also are seeing a landscape shift from a very fossil fuel-heavy infrastructure to a very diverse infrastructure. You're seeing states diversify their energy grids very quickly, and you're seeing our country and other countries diverse very quickly. When you see the intermittency and unreliability of and scale concerns that people have with solar and wind, how does that impact the strategy, if at all, or is it focused on finding technological developments to ease those concerns? What are you seeing from investors around solar and wind versus nuclear and natural gas and coal that are a little bit more stable 24 hours a day, but a little bit more traditional energy sources? Can you just kind of give a broader review of what that shift looks like?
Yeah, sure. Look, I think it's a great question. And one of the things that we're seeing is massive technological innovation in the renewable space. You're seeing it in greater efficiency and how it plays out. You know, larger wind blades or better solar PV capture. All those things are really important. But the reason why I say it's you need all of the above, I have a son who lives in Texas. He's lived in Texas for many years now. And one thing I've come to learn about Texas is that it's really hot in the summer. And on those hot summer afternoons, the wind doesn't blow very hard. And if you've ever been out there, you know that. Well, that's a problem if you're relying, if you were going to rely on wind for your power generation at that point. And so it's important that we have an all-of-the-above approach, or it's important that we have technological innovation like battery storage.
Right.
You know, BlackRock's been a big investor in battery storage. The technology there is really evolving incredibly rapidly. And so, you know, even a state like Texas is like the number one state in wind generation in the country. I think it's number two in solar, which is tremendous. But guess what? You know, there are times when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow, and you need natural gas primarily to cover that baseload capacity. And so I think from an investment perspective, we love the emerging technologies. We love the opportunity in renewable, right? Renewable growth has been about 15% a year for the last several years compared to 1% for traditional energy sources. That tells you something.
Right,
it tells you about technological innovation. It tells you about affordability. It tells you about direction. At the same time, I don't think that means that these other sources go away. And the folks who want them to go away, or want them to go away really quickly, I think are not thinking about what the implications of that are for reliability and also affordability. And some of those things are, frankly, very regressive.
Well, I'm struck by this approach because this is not what we hear from – I mean, what you're saying to me is incredibly pragmatic. It's also what I'm hearing from the scientific community. It's what I'm hearing from the sensible members of Congress who are working on this. It's what I'm hearing from largely the business community. But it's not what we're hearing in the narrative. It's and even about BlackRock, it's not what we're hearing about BlackRock. I guess this isn't even something that I plan on talking about, but how do you, like, from the narrative standpoint, is it, how frustrating is it to be combating this kind of, this noise that doesn't accurately describe what's going on in the marketplace, nor what BlackRock's doing? Is there a way around that? Do you see that that is kind of a big hindrance in the ability to just do business every day?
Look, you know, as an investment manager, again, I started this company, it was very small. We never thought people would care that much about what we say. And it's important that we get the message out.
Right.
And so, yeah, I never thought I'd be spending as much time as I do in Washington, D.C., or in Austin, or in lots of other state capitals around the world, talking to policymakers, either at the state or federal level, about this. I will say this. One thing that I've been struck with over the last, you know, really 2 years since we've really started to focus on this much more is you get a good hearing. I mean, people are willing to engage and have a debate, and I have a lot of respect for that. I'd be lying to you if I didn't say it wasn't frustrating when people say, oh, BlackRock is trying to do this or BlackRock's trying to do that. And some of the stuff is a little comical, frankly. But, you know, the most important thing is that we don't want to get in the way of our ability to serve our clients and generate returns for our clients. And, you know, I used to be of the belief there was no such thing as good publicity. Let's just stay out of the papers. The reality is that $9 trillion, the ability to keep your head below the parapet, well, that ship sailed a long time ago. And so I think we are spending more time on trying to help people understand what it is we do, what's our approach. And by the way, not everyone likes it, but at least they know there's facts.
Right.
You may not like the facts, but they're the facts. And that's what our goal has been.
Well, and from a personal interjection, I mean, as somebody who got into this from a fiscal conservative mindset, I do get really frustrated when I see politicians from what I traditionally would consider my own side going after companies like BlackRock without even trying to understand what the company's doing, or are very adamantly opposing what BlackRock's doing, even though they know what they're doing is very aligned actually with conservative principles. I think a lot of it's political pandering, and it's very frustrating. It's also not conservative oftentimes, the at least the principles that are being espoused, and that's just my own personal opinion. But I think that where it comes down to is that we've oversimplified so many things in the news media and in politics that it's really easy to make it an us versus them thing. You've even addressed that there are valid concerns that people have about the transition that's happening. Does that mean that it's black and white, BlackRock's evil, or BlackRock's the best thing in the entire world. No, but it's really easy to make it that way in this very 30-second soundbite media world we live in. And I can imagine that you're tempering some of that frustration because you have to, but I would be incredibly frustrated if I was you. And I can't imagine that frustration, especially as you're trying to deal with it from both sides.
Well, Benji, I appreciate that. I appreciate your listeners, too. Because if you're listening to this and you've made it this far, you're not doing the 140 character type sound bites. And I do think that, as we kind of help people understand what we do, and frankly, as we learn through this process, there's a much richer dialogue developing. I'm hopeful. You got to be an optimist in this thing. But in terms of, what are traditionally conservative principles, look, we built this company from literally zero to have $100 billion market cap. There is no bigger believer in free markets than BlackRock. That's what we rely on every day to be able to do what we do. And ultimately, the markets will determine what's the right way to produce energy. All right, and that's going to react to technological changes, to investor preferences, and to policy. Right, we can't ignore policy in this. The market will tell us what's the right way.
And when the government, state or federal, decides winners and losers in different industries, that is far, far worse than when the market decides for themselves, and history has proven that over and over again. So to get back to BlackRock's strategy for a second, my girlfriend works in ESG, a lot of my friends work in ESG. A lot of the questions that I hear about are the tracking. And how do you track? So you obviously can track returns and financial returns from investments, but in terms of the impact of those investments from the environmental specific side, but you can talk about the SG, the social governance as well. Is there a tracking mechanism that you use to see what environmental impacts these investments are having? Is there one that you want to see that you haven't, that the marketplace hasn't been able to design yet? What does tracking the impact look like outside of the dollars and cents?
Yeah, look, I'd say a couple things. One, again, we have clients who choose to have specific, sustainable-oriented objectives, right? If your objective is to invest in renewables, right, you want to track how much energy you've been able to produce and what the delta for carbon is, right? And to the extent that you've produced that, and by the way, you accurately measure that, because you can't just talk about, that a wind farm or a solar farm produces no carbon, because you had to create those materials.
Right.
But when you compare them accurately, I think that's a valid measure. You can do that in lots of different things. But I think most people are not concerned specifically with sustainable objectives. They're concerned with their broader portfolios. If you're the big teacher's retirement system in a different state, right, you're concerned about being able to pay for teacher's retirement. And, we take into account factors. We take into account environmental factors. We take into account changing consumer preferences, right? It would be crazy not to. How could you do that if you're building a building or investing in a building in a place where climate change is affecting the weather or sea level or extreme weather events? And by the way, fine. Let's concede that I don't know what the cause of those extreme weather events is, but if there are many more extreme weather events in a particular area than we saw before, how can you not take that into account if you're investing in a company that's going to be insuring those properties or located? And so I think there's some narrative that, oh my God, ESG is not financially relevant and you shouldn't take it into account. I got to be honest, that's a bit of a head-in-the-sand approach. And, the ostrich approach is not a great way to invest.
Right.
And so what we try to do is look for financial materiality, all right? That's the key. What's financially material to the returns of the company? And there are a lot of things. I mean, we've seen recently, great examples of governance failures, right? Like, that's a problem. We've seen companies have to pay huge sums of money for discrimination lawsuits, right? That's financially material. We also see changing policy and changing a changing regulatory environment. And again, you may like the changing regulatory environment, you may not like the changing regulatory environment, but it affects asset prices. And so, you know, our job is to try to understand one of these things. I will say this, the notion that you can roll up all ESG things into a single score is not really financially useful. Mm-hmm. And not something that our investors would pay particular attention to.
So from the tracking perspective, okay, maybe it's not possible to do a single score. We also know that, I mean, outside of BlackRock, the ESG world is very large and everyone's kind of using different metrics. Do you think of tracking the progress? Do you think that there is a way to have different similar metrics that are used? Is that is that something that the government needs to set? Is it something that private companies need to keep I mean, I know private companies have already tried, and private nonprofits and NGOs have tried. Do you think that the metrics do need to be set in a fairly uniform way, even if there are multiple of them and they're ever changing? Do you see the landscape of that changing, or do you think each company just kind of needs to report those metrics on its own?
Look, I it's funny. I was working from home a while ago when we were all stuck at home. And my wife yelled at me that I had to clean up my home office because it was kind of a mess. And I was going through some old files, and I pulled out a file from 2014 of kind of some early work that we had done on sustainability with some things around our analytics. And I started flipping through it. And I actually brought it to our daily investor meeting to kind of show people that, oh my God, here we were 7 years later at the time, or whatever it was, 8 years later, and what a massive change. So what we thought was state-of-the-art analytics in 2014, and I compared it to when you go into your drawer and you find your old iPhone 3, and you pull it out, and if you can find that funny wide charger that you need for it and plug it in and charge it up, do that and compare it to your device today, right? And so what we thought was really cool and really sophisticated at the time is completely outdated, completely. And so this is changing very fast, and it's evolving. And our analytic frameworks and our ability to understand financial materiality gets better every day. And that's what we've been focused on. So, yeah, I think, you know, at BlackRock, we've been spending a lot of time on that to try to understand what's the financial materiality of variety, different kind of sustainable-oriented measures, just like we do for central bank policy or credit risk or what have you. But, you know, having grown up in the mortgage market in the 1980s, you saw the incredible change that happened over a relatively short period of time. We're experiencing that in sustainability. And by the way, there were problems too.
Right?
There are things that you find out don't work. You thought worked, they didn't work. And so I do think that we're getting more consistency. I'm not a personal believer in having the government tell us which are the right metrics. I do think that BlackRock urges for more disclosure. We always want more disclosure. We want to know more. We want to be able to evaluate companies better. And the more they can tell us, the better we can be at our job. I don't think there's a single standard that is going to emerge. I do think that the analytics that are available will get more sophisticated, more accurate, more financially material through time. And, you know, BlackRock is going to play a role in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really refreshing to hear that it's this process that is evolving quickly, but it's also not going to be perfect. And I think people throughout time, we've had so many different economic transitions in different sectors of the economy, and sustainability is a big transition that's happening within multiple sectors. but it's not going to be perfect because you're going to fail every once in a while, and I think people, you know, can't be afraid of that, especially when things are overall moving in the right direction, largely with costs and affordability, reliability, etc. And if that's at the mindset, you're not going to be perfect, but you're going to keep moving in the right direction, and it seems like that's kind of at the ethos of what you're talking about.
Yeah, Benji, and you also have to think about time frames, right?
Yeah.
An energy transition is a long duration event, and honestly, I actually happen to believe it's going to be longer than most people predict. I think it will take longer. Again, that's a source of frustration for some people.
Yeah.
But I think to do that in a way that preserves kind of economic growth for the maximum number of human beings on this planet is going to take some time. So when you think about the tools that you use, you know, they're relatively long-dated instruments.
Yeah.
And people point, oh my God, you know, energy companies or oil companies outperformed this quarter or underperformed that quarter as if like that's some grand indicator of whether or not, you know, sustainability works or any particular measure works. It's just not how the whole system works.
Right. There's not some perfect incremental scale of growth towards where we want to be that's the same every quarter, every month, every year. And I think that's really important for people to understand. There's also no magic wand to fix some of the issues with the transition to happen as fast as some people want. And I think that you're exactly dead on that. So I think one of the more fun parts of the way to think about ESG and the work that BlackRock's doing as well is thinking about the role that the next generation has. And I run an organization with members in all 50 states. We've got a really amazing presence of people who actually think very economically about how we move towards this. How do you see the next generation leading on sustainability, maybe within the company, but also in the marketplace? And how much are young people driving that transition and how BlackRock's thinking about it?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. And I think young people have a really critical role to play in not only creating the energy ecosystem of the future, but also in BlackRock. And, you know, we hire every year, give or take, 450, 500 new college grads to join the firm. And I have the rare honor and privilege of getting to talk to them usually on their first day at BlackRock. And I tell them it's my favorite day of the year because it is just such a jolt, a caffeine jolt to the whole system. They bring new ideas, they bring new energy, they bring new perspectives. That's really how we're going to grow. So we've always been, you know, hugely committed to helping people develop, you know, in their careers and grow great careers at BlackRock, because that's where the push for new energy and new ideas and innovation comes from, for doing things in different ways. And I got to tell you, I think the energy industry is the exact same thing. And if you look, it's one of those industries where there's just going to be massive technological innovation. And whether that's in new ways and more efficient ways to extract fossil fuels,
right,
or whether that's in ways to store carbon, or whether that's in ways to, you know, using renewables or in decarbonization technologies. We didn't talk about blue hydrogen. We didn't talk about ammonia. We didn't talk about all the other things that you can do.
Emerging ideas. Yeah.
I just think the role of kind of young people and innovation in this is huge. And by the way, to your listeners out there, you know, if you're interested in working at BlackRock, please come apply. We really do want people who are passionate about our clients and about this the markets that come work here, especially people who can really bring new ideas.
Well, whether it's Bill Gates or BlackRock or Benji, you know, there's a lot of people out there saying there's a technological and innovation gap that we have to fill if we're going to further ourselves on this transition. And what I'm hearing from you is kind of what I've heard from some of the smartest, you know, people in the world, which is that younger generations not just need to vote the right way and think about this the right way, it's also they need to have the ideas in the private sector that help us move closer and closer to where we need to be. And that's, whether that's in BlackRock or with a startup or an energy company, there are a lot of really innovative new ideas out there. And they came largely from young people who came up with them. And the whole crop of the next generation should be inspired to do the same, because it's what it's going to take. I know we're limited on time, so a last kind of final question for you is vision casting. You've got, you know, potentially decades or centuries of this transition left. With all that's happening on this, you know, what does the future of sustainability and clean energy look like? Do you see on the horizon fairly broadly? And maybe what challenges do you see coming from those changes that we're going to endure over the next decade or two specifically?
Look, I think a couple themes out there. One, focus on energy security. All right. If there's one thing that we learned from the Russian invasion of Ukraine, was that, you know, energy security is absolutely critical for everyone. Two is reliable and affordable energy. You can't have a transition that, you know, diminishes reliability or makes energy unaffordable, especially for some of the most vulnerable people in society. And third is lower emissions, right?
Yep.
All those three things are going to be there. And so what's going to drive that and what's driving the transition? I think you're going to see it driven by technology. And whether that's in renewables or whether that's in decarbonization or whether that's just in more efficient extraction and capture of carbon, that's going to be critical. You're seeing changing preferences in society, right? Consumer behavior. At the end of the day, consumer behavior and investor preference is going to be the determinant of what's the winning technologies and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
And, there is a huge amount of focus on greener products, greener assets. And I think as we observe impacts of the physical effects of climate change, which tend to be very visible, mm-hmm. it's the more real
right.
Impacts. You're going to see increased focus on that, and then policy, right? And again, you may like it, you may not like it, but policy impacts this transition a lot. And to the extent that we've seen big support recently in the United States and in Europe. For renewables and for carbon credits, that affects asset prices. And again, I'm not advocating for them being good or bad. What I am saying is, given the current policy that's out there, it's created some interesting investment opportunities. So all those things, I think, are on the horizon, are going to be critical parts of this transition as they play out. And by the way, guess what? Technology is going to change over time. Kind of consumer preferences are going to change over time. And if there's one thing that's, you know, my years on this earth have taught me, is that policy will change over time. And good investors are going to have to adapt.
Well, Rich, it's been a pleasure, and it's not just because you brought me a nice tea, but I couldn't really disagree with much you said today, and there's so much, I think what you said, you've got to have an optimistic outlook. There's so much optimism in the way that the world is turning on this, and if you ignore the noise of the protests that you've had to endure from both sides and some of the very politicized kind of attacks, there's a lot of really good stuff happening here, and I you've taken such a pragmatic approach in this conversation, and I think from what I've seen through some of our mutual friends, and Paul Bodnar and some other folks that I've gotten to work with, there are a lot of really great steps happening, and for the next generation to know that companies with that big of an impact are thinking about it, but also not just thinking about it into what sounds good and feels good, but really does good economically and also socially for people of all backgrounds and ethnicities and parts of the world. And I think we've got a real opportunity here. So thank you for sitting down and explaining that. I think a lot of politicians and people who haven't had the chance to do so hopefully will. And I'll keep pushing this to them. And I just really appreciate your time.
Yeah, Benji, I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you.
And before we jump, the Coming Clean podcast is grateful to be powered by Ørsted, a wonderful company strengthening America's energy security with reliable and domestic clean energy. Through its integrated renewable energy solutions, Ørsted is creating American jobs, investing in American communities, and driving American innovation, all while preserving our country's natural habitats. A clean energy future truly connects us all, and Ørsted is helping lead the charge. To learn more, visit us.ørsted.com.